It's Tuesday, July 1st, and it's 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. And continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers. It's July 1st, and that means it's Canada Day up in Canada, also known sometimes as Canada's Birthday or formerly known as Dominion Day. It marks the July 1st, 1867 creation of the Canadian Federation, which continued under British rule up until 1982 when the Constitution Act patriated the Canadian Constitution. It's not really like Independence Day in that there's no particular clear-cut day, but the Canadians nevertheless celebrate this day as Canada's birthday with all sorts of patriotic national celebrations going on all across the Great White North. And in that spirit, we're going to go to Vancouver, British Columbia today to speak with Philippe Lucas, who's the executive director of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society. His group is behind an important legal challenge to Health Canada's running of the Canadian medical marijuana system. We're also going to Fresno, California to speak with Aaron Smith from Marijuana Policy Project, who will be talking about the screening of the documentary Waiting to Inhale, whose director we interviewed on yesterday's Stash, as well as the status of creating a medical marijuana ID card system in Fresno. Also, we've got our regular musical break for you and my July 1st look at the 35th birthday of the Drug Enforcement Administration. That's right. Today on Canada Day, the DEA of the United States turns 35. We'll take a look at what $31 billion and 35 years of DEA drug warfare have done in the war on
certain American citizens using non-pharmaceutical, non-alcoholic, tobacco-free
drugs. So sit back and relax, eh? Have a brew and a back bacon sandwich and enjoy your normal daily audio stash. Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our normal daily audio stash, Hemp Headlines. U.S. leads world in drug use, from Bloomberg.com. Cocaine and marijuana have been tried by more Americans than residents of 16 other countries surveyed, researchers said, even though tough U.S. drug laws seek to discourage the use of the drugs. In the U.S., 42% said they had used marijuana and 16% had tried cocaine, according to the study published in the Journal of the Public Library of Science. In the Netherlands, where people can go to cafes to smoke marijuana, 20% have tried that drug, and 1.9% sampled cocaine. The higher incidence of drug use in the U.S. may be linked to the nation's relative affluence, not its anti-drug laws, said James Anthony, chairman of the epidemiology department at Michigan State University's Medical School in East Lansing, Michigan, and an author of the study. The study authors wrote, quote, Drug use is related to income, but does not appear to be simply related to drug policy, since countries with more stringent policies toward illegal drug use did not have lower levels of such drug use than countries with more liberal policies, end quote. Anthony said, quote, in the Netherlands, despite a less restrictive approach, the population hasn't taken up cannabis smoking to the extent that's true in the U.S. or New Zealand, end quote. Trying to find a link between drug use and drug enforcement doesn't make sense, said Tom Riley, a spokesman for the U.S. Office of National Drug Control Policy in Washington. Riley said yesterday, quote, the U.S. has high crime rates, but we spend a lot on law enforcement and prison. Should we spend less? We're just a different kind of country. We have higher drug use rates, a higher crime rate, many things that go with a highly free and mobile society, end quote. Yes, Mr. Riley, we should spend less, or more accurately, we should spend a lot of that prison and drug war money for funding education and drug treatment. I'm a bit confused by the idea that we have higher crime and drug use rates because we are a, quote, highly free and mobile society, end quote. I've never been outside the United States, and that's a sin I'll repent for someday. But aren't Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, Israel, Japan, and New Zealand also highly free and mobile societies? And then there's also the irony of the spokesman who represents an agency sworn to lock you up if you smoke cannabis saying that we are highly free. And if you do a little more digging, you'll find that the racist underpinnings of the drug war are really what they are referring to by a highly free and mobile society. I've read this line from the drug czar before when confronted with the metrics of their own failures in reducing drug problems in the U.S. You can't compare the U.S. and Europe or the Netherlands because we have different cultures. NIDA director Dr. Nora D. Volkow said, quote, in addition to the factors measured in this study, the role of culture, drug availability, and knowledge about drug use are likely to be important in the types and patterns of drug use throughout the world. Even within the United States, rates and patterns of substance use differ based on geographical location and ethnicity, among other factors, end quote. Well, according to your own NIDA report on drug use among racial and ethnic minorities, use of marijuana among whites is more prevalent than Hispanic use, but less prevalent than black use. However, all drug use, legal and illegal, was far less prevalent among Asians and Pacific Islanders. So, couldn't you say that the ethnic problem in America regarding drugs includes the white Americans too? The white folks in the Netherlands aren't using as much drugs as the white folks in America. Missouri town finds drug agent is really an imposter. From the New York Times, Gerald, Missouri. Like so many rural communities in the country's middle, this tiny town had wrestled for years with the woes of methamphetamine. Then, several months ago, a federal agent showed up. Bus began. Houses were ransacked. People in handcuffs on their front lawns named names. To some, like Mayor Otis Schulte, who considers the county around Gerald, population 1171, a, quote, meth capital of the United States, end quote, the drug scourge seemed to be fading at last. Those whose homes were searched, though, grumbled about a peculiar change in what they understood, from television mainly, to be the law. They said the agent, a man some had come to know as Sergeant Bill, boasted that he did not need search warrants to enter their homes because he worked for the federal government. Look, I know after all of this USA Patriot Act and FISA wrangling by the administration and Congress, it can be difficult to remember exactly what tiny shreds of the Fourth Amendment we still have in place, but I think search warrants to physically enter homes still applies. But after a reporter for the local weekly newspaper made a few calls about that claim, Gerald's anti-drug campaign abruptly unraveled after less than 5 months. Sergeant Bill, it turned out, was no federal agent, but Bill A. Jacob, an unemployed former trucking company owner, a former security guard, a former wedding performing minister, a former small town cop, from 23 miles down the road. Mr. Jacob, age 36, is now the subject of a criminal investigation by federal authorities and is likely to face charges relating to impersonating a law enforcement officer, his lawyer said. The strange adventures of Sergeant Bill have led to the firing of three of the town's five police officers, left the outcome of a string of drug arrests in doubt, prompted multi-million dollar federal civil rights lawsuits by at least 17 plaintiffs, and stirred up a political battle, including a petition seeking the impeachment of Mr. Schulte over who is to blame for the mess. And the questions keep coming. How did Mr. Jacob wander into town and apparently leave the mayor, the alderman, and pretty much everyone else he met thinking that he was a federal agent delivered from Washington to help barrel into people's homes and clean up Gerald's drug problem? And why would anyone, receiving no pay and with no known connection to little Gerald, 70 miles from St. Louis and not even a county seat, want to carry off such a time-consuming ruse in the first place? Why? Because people of small character and low self-worth enjoy playing tough guy. It's the same guy who would go to the great extremes as a kid to bully other kids. This Sergeant Bill pleaded guilty to misdemeanor sexual abuse of a teen girl when he was 22. Another type of bullying. He's failed in his business pursuits, and he played small-town cop before, but never long enough to have been state-certified. He's a puffed-up loser who gets his kicks thinking he's some vigilante superhero ridding the world of the drug scourge. He needs to feel superior and righteous, and what better underclass to bully than the reviled meth zombies? He's just another pompous, arrogant, self-aggrandizing, cruel, mendacious, predatory, sanctimonious, reprobate drug warrior who failed to qualify for a badge first.
Marijuana is an addictive drug, which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face-to-face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
The DEA turns 35 today. Happy birthday, DEA! Celebrating 35 years of making recreational drugs more plentiful, more potent, lower priced, easier to acquire, and filling America's prisons to world record levels.
The Drug Enforcement Administration was created by President Richard Nixon through an executive order on July 1, 1973, in order to establish a single unified command to combat, quote, an all-out global war on the drug menace, end quote. At its outset, the DEA had 1,470 special agents and a budget of less than $75 million. Furthermore, in 1974, the DEA had 43 foreign offices in 31 countries. Today, the DEA has 5,235 special agents, a budget of more than $2.3 billion, and 86 foreign offices in 62 countries.
So, the DEA turns 35 today. That deserves a special celebration. Let's bust out our handy-dandy calculator and the official government stats. It's time to play Rate the DEA. Today, the DEA has twice the offices in twice the countries with four times the manpower than when it started 35 years ago. In 1973, the DEA had a $75 million budget to work with. Today, the DEA has a $2,300 million budget to work with. That's a greater than 30-fold increase. And just what have the American people received for this $31 billion 35-year investment? Are there fewer drugs now? That's hard to say, since nobody's out there taking official inventories of illegal drugs. But judging by the Office of National Drug Control Policy's figures that show drug seizures from 1989 to 2003, it seems that there are plenty of drugs out there. In that time frame, marijuana and heroin seized by law enforcement about doubled, and cocaine seizures remained steady. Well, those drugs have got to be harder to get, right? All those seizures and agents and arrests must mean the price of drugs has gone up. But, according to the ONDCP's report on the price and purity of drugs, from 1981 to 2003, cocaine is about one-fifth as expensive, crack is about one-third as expensive, heroin is one-sixth as expensive, and meth is half as expensive. However, the safest of all recreational drugs, marijuana, did double in price. Okay, so there are more cheaper drugs that are easier to get, but surely they've got to be less potent. According to the survey previously mentioned, cocaine is about 50% more pure, crack's purity hasn't changed much, heroin is 3 times more pure, meth purity is about the same, and according to the recently released report from the Drug Czar's Marijuana Potency Monitoring Project, marijuana potency doubled from 1985 to 2007.
Oh, gnarly!
Wow. After 35 years of escalating DEA budgets, we've got cheaper, more powerful, more plentiful drugs. But maybe now we have fewer drug users? No. According to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, in 1979, 31% of the population aged 12 or older had ever used drugs. By 2006, that figure increased to 45%. On a per capita basis, the percentage of drug users increased by about half, or in raw figures, the people who ever used drugs doubled from 56 million to 111 million. I would hope at least, with quadruple the number of agents and 30 times the budget, the DEA would at least have more arrests to show for it. Well, according to the FBI's Uniform Crime Reports, we did go from 628,000 drug law arrests in 1973 to almost 1.9 million drug law arrests in 2006. That is about triple the number of arrests. Has the increase in arrests at least helped save people's lives? Well, according to the Centers for Disease Control, back in 1979, 513 Americans died from overdoses on opiates, cocaine, and meth. By 1998, 9 times more Americans died from those illegal drugs, 4,942 Americans. Yikes! More people are dying from using more plentiful, more powerful drugs. Perhaps we're not getting to them early enough. What about the children? Didn't we at least end up with fewer high school seniors using drugs? Well, according to the Monitoring the Future survey, often cited by the DEA, in 1975, 45% of 12th graders had ever tried an illicit drug. In 2006, the number of seniors who tried drugs was 36.5%, a decline of less than one-fifth. So, not only more adults using cheaper, more powerful, more plentiful drugs, but barely a dent in the kids using these drugs. But as the U.S. population has increased, overall, there are more teenage drug users. Has the DEA at least made it harder for the kids to get drugs? According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, in 1992, 60% of teenagers said marijuana was easy to obtain, 40% said the same about cocaine, and about a quarter said they could get heroin easily. In 2006, half of all teenagers say it's easy to get pot, a quarter say it's easy to get cocaine, and about one-seventh say it's easy to get heroin. Well, alright, then we've seen the use and availability of drugs drop by roughly one-fifth among teenagers in 14 years. But when a third of kids have tried drugs, and half of them say drugs are easy to get, I don't think that's much of a success story for a $31 billion 35-year effort. Bigger budgets, more drugs. More arrests, more deaths. More seizures, more potency. More agents, more users. For their 35th anniversary, perhaps they should change their name to the Drug Encouragement Administration.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 12 states today, and THCF has medical clinics in 6 of those states. Our physicians help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms as in multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help them obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Nevada, Hawaii, and California. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at www.hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
We're going to move up to the Great White North for just a moment here and talk a little bit about the state of medical marijuana in the country of Canada. And joining us by telephone from Vancouver is Philippe Lucas, who's the executive director of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society. You can learn more about them at www.thevix.com, and we'll have links to that up at our site. Philippe, welcome back to the Stash.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here on Canada Day.
I was going to say, happy Canada Day to you.
I appreciate it.
So we received a press release here from Vancouver Island Compassion Society about an update to your constitutional challenge of Health Canada's medical cannabis policy. Let's tell our listeners just a little bit about what your challenge is. How did this all come about, and what are you challenging about Canada's medical marijuana policies?
Sure. Well, in Canada, we've had legal access to medical cannabis, or legal rights to access medical cannabis, I should say, because the actual access part has been a tricky aspect of this since 1999. And the Vancouver Island Compassion Society has been in operation since 1999. We're currently supplying medical cannabis and doing medical cannabis research here in Victoria, B.C., and we're currently supplying about 790 people with access to a safe source of cannabis. In 2003, in an attempt to get away from the black market prices and some quality fluctuations that were giving us concern on the black market, we started our own production facility in order to produce a safe, standardized source of cannabis that we could use both for research as well as for distribution to our membership. And unfortunately, about 18 months into that, the life of that production facility, the RCMP, or the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, our federal police enforcement, stumbled upon it, raided the facility, and closed it down. And so we've been in court for the last 4 years as a result of that raid, and we've launched a constitutional challenge, or a charter challenge, against the federal program for not protecting legitimate medical cannabis users in Canada, and additionally for not supplying a safe source of high-quality cannabis to those who could benefit from its use.
Now, how many citizens in Canada are currently using medical marijuana under federal protection, and how many do you estimate could be using it?
Well, according to the Canadian Center for Substance Abuse's Canadian Addiction Survey, which is a broad-based survey not dissimilar to your National Household Survey in the U.S., there's currently about 3 to 4% of the adult population claim to be using cannabis in Canada for medical purposes, and that's actually over a million Canadians. And yet, in the 7 years of this federal program, we've so far only 2,400 Canadians have been able to register with the program and enjoy the legal protections of it. So as you can see, 99.9% of medical cannabis users in Canada are not protected by our federal program. Mm. And that leaves them vulnerable to arrest, to persecution, and to the stigma associated with medical cannabis use. And so it's an ongoing problem here.
Now, this production facility that got raided, I imagine you guys started this up as a response to Health Canada's very poor quality medical cannabis. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, we the Compassion Society actually predates the federal medical marijuana program, but you're absolutely right that in 2003, the federal government started supplying cannabis in August of 2003. They supply a single strain of cannabis growing, it's grown 500 feet below ground in a mine in Flint Flon, Manitoba, which is one of Canada's, frankly, one of North America's most environmentally contaminated areas for over 80 years of smelting. And that source of cannabis has been widely rejected by the medical cannabis community. In fact, out of the 2,400 people who've joined the Health Canada program, only about 20% access their cannabis through Health Canada, and out of those, 70% have been unable or have chosen not to pay for it. And so right now, what we've got is literally hundreds of medical cannabis patients who are in debt to Health Canada over $500,000 for this poor quality cannabis supply.
How does Health Canada justify this this poor production. It's not as if, you know, there's not anybody in Canada that knows how to grow good marijuana.
Well, in the past, they've said that that end users are just being too picky, that these quality concerns that were being put forward by end users were merely kind of nitpicking or gilding the lily. I think that now they're starting to realize that there's some obvious truth to the fact that different strains have different effects, that different methods of ingestion have different effects on different conditions as well. And so they're just starting to come around to knowledge that's been commonly known from in the medical cannabis community for some time now. Whether it be San Francisco or Vancouver, BC, or Toronto, those involved with medical cannabis access and distribution have known for a long time that we need to make multiple strains available and we need to make multiple methods of ingestion available, because there is no single strain or single way of ingesting cannabis that's going to work for everyone.
Absolutely. So you just had, it looks as if you just had some expert witness testimony that concluded. What was the nature of the testimony? How did it go? Do you anticipate a positive result from this challenge?
Well, we've been in the D.C. Supreme Court now for 4 years. Over the last 12 months or so, we've had about 40 days in court. We've benefited a lot from the experiences in Canada as well as the U.S. We had Dr. Bob Melamed, a professor out of University of Colorado, Colorado Springs, come up and testify on the therapeutic benefits of cannabis, as well as the potential dangers of gamma radiation, which is a decontamination technique used by our government on the federal cannabis supply. We had some great testimony from Senator Pierre-Claude Nolan, who was chair of the Senate Special Committee on Illegal Drugs up here in Canada, that in 2002 recommended the legalization of cannabis for adults in Canada, and as well as some great testimony from some members of the Compassion Society, of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society themselves, who'd had their cannabis supply cut off from Health Canada, who'd had collection agencies contact them on because of non-payment of cash owed to Health Canada. And so we've had some great testimony all throughout, and we've built a very strong case. We feel that we've exposed the problems with the program in a way that's never been done before. This is, without a doubt, the most comprehensive legal challenge that's been launched against this program. And that's saying quite something, because this program has actually been found unconstitutional three different times in the last 5 years. So this is a program that's had trouble meeting its legal obligations right from the get-go. And I think that stems back from the history of it, which is that although Canada benefits from a national medical marijuana program, it's not something any of our governments have suddenly decided to do out of a sense of compassion or obligation to our critically and chronically ill population. It was a court-ordered program. In other words, they were sued by a medical user, and they had no choice but to put in place a federal medical marijuana program. And we've seen that they've done so, much like the U.S.'s own IND program, with great resistance at every step of the way.
Almost as if they want to design it to fail to prove a political point.
Well, absolutely. And when you look at the application process, which, by the way, application, you can see that it's not designed to be something to encourage people to join the program. And it's... I was sad to hear the other day, as I was registering an older woman, that she called Health Canada, and our program has, the department that runs the program has the ironic title of being called the Medical Marijuana Access Division. I say it's ironic because their sole purpose seems to be to stop people from accessing medical cannabis by making them jump through hoops, putting up unnecessary safeguards to what we all know as certainly a comparatively safe and effective medicine compared to not only pharmaceutical prescription drugs, but also simple over-the-counter medications.
Well, it's good to know that the George W. Bush administration doesn't have the lock on silly names and ironic names for their government agencies.
No, we're doing our best up here to keep up. And in fact, when you look at some of the state-run U.S. Medical marijuana programs right now, you guys are in much better shape than we are here in Canada with our federal program. I like to look at Oregon as a good comparison, because Oregon's got exactly one-tenth the population of Canada. Oregon's got 3 million people. We've got 30 million. Oregon's program also started the same year as ours, 1999, and yet over that period of time, the Oregon programs managed to register over 16,000 people, while our program, with 10 times the population, has only registered 2,500 people, 2,400 people. So you can see that there's either the people in Oregon are unfortunately and tragically much more ill than Canadians and therefore need much greater access to medical cannabis, or we've got some bureaucratic process that's standing in the way to safe access here. And I think that obviously I favor the latter explanation.
Yeah, I think a lot of it would also owe to, you know, the difference between a grassroots citizen-born initiative-style program versus one that's forced upon a bureaucracy from a court decision.
Oh, and I think that's exactly right. And I think that you really see that reflected in the two parallel programs that are going on in Canada right now, which is the completely legal but absolutely ineffective Health Canada centralized federal program with a monopoly on access, production, and distribution, compared to the gray market Compassion Club program, which is basically a series of 10 to 12 community-based dispensaries scattered throughout Canada that are currently supplying about 14,000 Canadians with a safe source of cannabis. And we're also producing more research than Health Canada. We're producing more cannabis strains and a higher quality supply of cannabis than Health Canada, and we're doing all of this at no cost to the taxpayer. So I think that this is obviously the elephant in the room that needs to be discussed, and we've certainly urged Health Canada to enter in a cooperative discussion and dialogue with community-based dispensaries right from the inception of this program.
Well, there's all sorts of improvements we could recommend for the Health Canada program, and part of this, again, is your challenge here, this constitutional or charter challenge that you're engaged in. I know these kind of challenges, they can't be cheap. Is there any way that our listeners, especially in Canada and the United States, can donate or help to fund your charter challenge and improve the Health Canada medical marijuana program?
Absolutely, absolutely. We've been incredibly lucky with the support that we've had. Much of it coming from the U.S., by the way. We've really got to thank MPP, the Drug Policy Alliance, and people like Robert Field, who have been so generous in helping our charter challenge. It's been over $200,000 in legal bills so far, which is a tough pill to swallow for a small nonprofit like the Vancouver Island Compassion Society. And certainly anyone who can and would like to help, you can go to our website at www.thevics.com. And there's a link to be able to donate through PayPal there, through credit cards. And if you'd rather send a check or money order, there's also some information on how to do that. And we really appreciate it. We feel that this charter challenge is directed specifically at helping not just the members of our Compassion Society, but to help protect each and every Canadian who can benefit from the use of cannabis. And I have no doubt in my mind that if we could set up a working, effective medical marijuana program here in Canada, that it would have a great influence in particularly with the next, hopefully the next administration of the U.S. government, in bringing forward some more comprehensive federal legislation around medical cannabis access in the U.S.
Absolutely agreed. And folks, get on the net to thevics.com. Make your donations. It's your Canada Day present to our friendly neighbors up north.
Well, thank you very much, and in case we don't have a chance to talk 3 days from now, let me wish you guys a very happy 4th of July, and look forward to celebrating with my American friends then as well.
That's right. We're going to celebrate what parts of the Constitution we still have. Thanks a lot. We've been speaking with Philippe Lucas, who's the Executive Director of the Vancouver Island Compassion Society. Thanks for joining us again, Philippe.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our daily audio stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org. Good day, fellow stashers. Today we get to play in some beautiful folk genre music with Ass. Yes, Ass, a funny name for a talented Swede. His musical name is really an acronym for Andreas Soderstrom Solo. Mr. Soderstrom has worked with different artists and must have a great sense of humor. Today's cut, and Pass It to Each Other, is from the album My Get Up and Go Just Got Up and Went, which is a collection of acoustic guitar solos. This beautiful acoustic music is just what I needed when I realized it's only Tuesday and Friday seems a bit far. So mellow out with me, Stashers, as I pass this one on to you, and we all know to pass it on to each other. You can learn more about Andreas Soderstrom Solo, or Ass, at our website at stash.normal.org, and you can get a download of this tune. It's Ass with And Pass It to Each Other.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and co-workers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORMA. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORMAL, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Yesterday on the Daily Audio Stash, we spoke with Jed Reif, who is the documentary filmmaker behind Waiting to Inhale. Today, we're speaking with Aaron Smith, who's a California coordinator with the Marijuana Policy Project, and he has some news about this very same documentary. So, Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Russ.
So you've got a screening of this show going on with some special guests. Why don't you tell our listeners about that so that they can get involved?
Well, a great documentary. It's a great opportunity for people who may not be very familiar with the medical marijuana issue to see it from all ends. And, Jed's been hosting screenings of this throughout the country, and this one in Fresno we're really excited about because there's several issues going before, Fresno's community leaders regarding medical marijuana in the coming weeks. And actually, the day after the screening, the Board of Supervisors is supposed to be conducting a hearing on whether or not to immediately move forward with the state's medical marijuana ID card program. And so we've invited the supervisors and their staff to attend the screening and engage in a discussion about medical marijuana so that they're fully informed before making that vote on that following Tuesday.
Oh, okay. So when and where is the screening happening?
The screening is going to be in Clovis at the Unitarian Universalist Church, which Clovis is right outside of Fresno. And this is going to be at 7 p.m. on Monday, the 7th. And the vote of the Board of Supervisors is going to be taking place on the following Tuesday, the 8th. And the address for that is 2672 East Alluvial Ave, Clovis. That's for the church. Where the screening will be taking place at 7 p.m., and we expect a panel discussion to happen. It'll happen immediately following the screening, so it'll be at about 8:20, 8:30. And then the Board of Supervisors will be conducting their hearing at the county building on the 8th, and that's tentatively set for July 8th, 9 a.m. at the County Administration Center downtown.
Okay. Well, we'll have information for that up on our blog at stash.normal.org so people can get the address and the information. And you mentioned that you're going to be having a panel discussion. Who will be involved in the panel discussion?
We have Jed, who you talked to yesterday, will be moderating the panel, and I'll, myself, a local patient who relies on medical marijuana in Fresno, a local doctor who actually, Dr. Brown, who works as an emergency, he specializes in emergency medicine, but also is quite familiar with medical cannabis and has at times recommended medical marijuana to patients in Fresno. William McPike, who's a defense attorney, specializes in marijuana cases in Fresno as well. And we have invited folks from law enforcement. We've actually invited all the elected officials and major law enforcement agencies in the Fresno area to attend and sit on the panel or speak after the panel, however they want to do it. And it sounds as though we actually will have somebody from the Fresno Police Department in attendance. Can't say if they'll be on the panel or how it'll work out, but I'm kind of excited that we'll be able to, bounce ideas off of the local law enforcement and most importantly help to educate them about medical marijuana, because unfortunately Fresno is a part of the state where all too many patients are falsely arrested for marijuana when in fact they're not violating state law.
Now, is this part of the push then to enact this state mandated medical marijuana ID card program, is to try to help those patients?
Yeah, exactly. The ID card program is it's a voluntary program for patients, but it's mandatory that the county make it available. And what the cards do is they offer a really simple mechanism to identify a patient as someone who's qualified under state law to possess and cultivate marijuana for medical purposes. And, you know, in the past, and currently in Fresno County, many of the law enforcement officers will say, well, hey, I can't, you know, they'll be faced with a written recommendation from a doctor and say, I can't verify that. And they seize the marijuana, set a court date, and then just let the court work it out. And meanwhile, that's, you know, a nightmare for patients who are already suffering to be dragged through the judicial system, even though ultimately their cases are dismissed. And it's obviously a huge waste of taxpayer dollars to be arresting people who aren't criminals. And so the ID card program is a means of verifying qualification under the law. And it, you know, takes away that excuse from law enforcement, that excuse that, oh, well, we can't verify this because this is a state-run program that actually, you know, addresses that issue directly.
Now, I know there's other counties, I know, particularly San Diego County, San Bernardino County, that have openly resisted the ID card programs and, in fact, all aspects of Prop 215. Has this been an issue where Fresno has just not gotten around to it? Are they openly resistant to it? What's the political lay of this?
Well, you know, I mean, officially, yeah, they just haven't gotten around to it. But we've heard, you know, rumblings at the county that, oh, well, you know, this is a violation of federal law, and so we can't go forward with this. And, you know, but we've, you know, given them a clear message that this is, for one, issuing ID cards of any kind don't violate federal law. But two, most importantly, it's not their job to enforce federal law. And the courts agree with that. You know, San Diego and San Bernardino are just on an ideological witch hunt against medical marijuana, and they don't care that they're using their taxpayers their taxpayer money to pursue this futile lawsuit. But Fresno County hopefully will do the right thing by patients and voters and implement this program, despite, you know, the fact that a few rogue counties are not complying with the law.
Well, we've got the documentary Waiting to Inhale. This will be in Clovis, California, just right outside of Fresno. Check out our website at stash.normal.org. We'll have the wheres and the whens up there. But it's next Monday, July 7th at 7 p.m. And right the day after, we're anticipating, you say, the meeting by those Board of Supervisors. So we'll get everyone motivated and educated out there to make the best policy changes we can for the patients out there in Fresno. Aaron, thanks for doing this hard work for us.
Thank you, Russ.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.normal.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave today with another one of our cannabis quotes, this one from the writer Ken Kesey, who said, quote, "To be just without being mad, and the madder you get, the madder you get. To be peaceful without being stupid. To be interested without being compulsive. To be happy without being hysterical, smoke grass," end quote. Well, I think that just about sums it up. If we could get everybody who's drinking alcohol to switch to marijuana, this country would be a much safer, less violent place. I'm Radical Russ. Thanks for joining us here on the Daily Audio Stash, and happy Canada Day to all my Canadian friends. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.